This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 127. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products. Whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it, I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's up this week, Rob?
Well, what's up is that I heard you're working from a brand new piece of hardware. You ditched the MacBook Air.
For a MacBook Pro right now.
Jeez.
I saw that guy on Twitter who had mentioned that I was probably going to have to now that you got the new MacBook Air. And well, you know, I've just followed his advice. That's really what it was.
You heard that I had 8 gigs of RAM and half terabyte hard drive and got jealous?
Yep, I did. So now I've got 16 gigs of RAM.
That's
so
unbelievable, man. Yeah, that's a great piece of machinery.
If I had the model that you have right now, I probably wouldn't have bothered to upgrade. But the disk I/O on the new machine that I just got is 3 times what it was on my old MacBook Air, which the model that you have is newer. So, you know, it has better disk I/O, more RAM, and all these other things. So if I had that one, I probably wouldn't have upgraded. But it was a little over 2 years old at this point, and there were some things that I needed to be able to do that I just couldn't do. I'd be on the road and couldn't run things that I needed to run.
Sure. Well, hey, I'm starting an experiment this week. I am outsourcing the creation of my MicroConf presentation. And not the content itself, but just the creation of the slide deck. And I'm doing it for a couple reasons. I sat down just to kind of do a rough outline, get into a text file, and you know, opened up Ultra Edit, and I started typing what I wanted to see on each slide. And I got to the end, and I have, I don't know, 40 slides. It took me a couple hours to think through it all. I added as many numbers as I could. It's a 250-line text file. And I looked at it, and I thought to myself, you know what? Like, going from here into slides is actually kind of a trivial task. Like, it's super time consuming. I bet it'll take 8 to 10 hours at least to get all that into a format that's nice. And I realized, like, there are people that know Keynote way better than I do. For starters, I've never used Keynote. But secondarily, someone's going to just, they're going to be more of an expert at just presentations and doing things visually. So I hopped on Odesk and I found, sure enough, there are people who are like Keynote and PowerPoint and just presentation gurus. And so I have an open job right now. I'm down to about 3 candidates and I'm going to send them over my outline and have each do the first 5 slides and see what they come up with. So I'm kind of stoked about it. I'm interested to see if this pans out. Obviously, it's an experiment, right?
Yeah, I definitely did that at least one of the past 2 years. I think it was the first year where I was looking for a lot of different images and I had somebody else go through and I kind of told them what I wanted and then they just went through and picked out all the images and stuff and put it together for me. But it does work out. But that's a good idea to go to Odesk. I hadn't thought about that. So I do want to give a special thanks to Dan and Ian from the Lifestyle Business Podcast for helping us out with our April Fool's Day episode. I saw some tweets and feedback messages here and there, which definitely caught a couple of people unaware and definitely pranked them.
For the record, that was your idea just out of the blue, right? You, like, the week before April 1, you're like, hey, we should do this. And I'm like, man, I don't know if we have enough time to pull that together. You emailed Dan and Ian and we got it together quick. That was good. I think it turned out well. It looks like some folks were tricked for a little while and others knew right away that, you know, it was April Fool's. They were on their guard.
Yep. Today, we're going to talk about 7 tips for finishing your product. There's probably millions of abandoned software products out there that are sitting in source code repositories or on hard disks from developers who've started something and then just never finished it. And today, what we're going to do is we're going to walk through 7 tips for ensuring that you finish the product that you start.
You asked me how many products do you think that you started that never finished? And so that's, to be clear, I did launch several products that failed, and I'm not including any of those. But I bet I have at least 10 and maybe 15 half-completed code bases that I got at least 8 to 20 hours into and just abandoned. And some of them I got 80 to 100 hours into and really started getting into it and then just kind of left it by the wayside when I lost motivation. From all the interactions we have with founders constantly, we know that people, you know, are abandoning apps, not finishing their products. And so, you know, hopefully these tips we've pulled from our experience are helpful.
So the first tip that we have is don't chase everything that moves. You really need to be selective about the types of things that you start. And some of this goes back to doing your due diligence and pre-marketing efforts to make sure that whatever product it is that you're going to be launching or attempting to build is something that people actually want, because if you get to a point where you're 80, 100, 200 hours into it, and then you start talking to people, or then you start seeing competition that you didn't see before because you weren't really doing that due diligence, you're probably going to lose motivation. And, you know, it can be very distracting to have all these different ideas in your head. It's always exciting to start a new product. And when you start it, you have a lot of motivation up front. But unless you have the commitment to follow through with it, then you're obviously not going to finish it. So if you start chasing everything, that's going to become a huge problem, and you're not going to finish most of the things that you do start. So definitely be selective about the things that you start, and understand whether or not there's going to be a market for those things.
This is such a tough balance. One time, it was about 5 years ago, and I was working with, this is back when I was in New Haven, Connecticut, working with a couple of Yale MBAs, and they were trying to get angel funding for this idea we had. And at a certain point, we cranked through several different ideas, and we went and tried to do customer development. This is before it was called that, but we were trying to talk to end users and figure out what their needs were, and it was a long process. And we did that for one idea, and then we scrapped it. And then we did it for a second idea, and we scrapped it. And this, you know, months go by during this time, and you start to get antsy, and you start to feel like you're wasting time. And what I realized is that it really, there were two types of people in of the three of us. There were two types of personalities. One guy finally said, you know, we just need to pick an idea and go with it. In my head, that sounds good, but then you're not vetting anything, right? You don't have a lot of confidence that idea is going to go, and you are just randomly choosing how you're going to spend the next year or two of your life. And so obviously he was the personality of, he just wanted to get moving with the app. And I bet all of us have a little bit of that in us. I, on the other hand, really wanted to know that what we were going to build was going to be worthwhile, that people needed it, right? That there was actually a market need, and that we were building something that people wanted. I think those are kind of the two sides of this coin. And all of us have some of those two. It's not a dichotomy. You're not either or, but you have some of each. And knowing yourself and knowing whether you are more of a person who just is going to jump on the first thing, or who's going to just sit in analysis paralysis for months and months, knowing that about yourself is very important to actually get something off the ground that has a reasonable chance of success.
So tip number two is to budget your time, energy, and other resources. And if you bite off too much for a particular project all at once, you're a lot less likely to stick with it. So you need to budget how you're going to reach any of the major milestones by setting up a schedule for the different resources you have available. And whether those resources are time, they're money, they could be contractors that you have that are working for you. Maybe you've set aside a couple $1,000s and you need them to meet certain milestones by certain time periods, or certain amounts of money that you've set aside for them to accomplish those tasks. Those things you really need to keep a tight watch on, so that you are meeting those milestones. Because if you start falling behind, it's going to be very difficult to catch up later, because you can't catch up when it comes to code. If you've got 10 different things that you need to implement and you're behind and you've only implemented three of them, it's very difficult to catch up on the rest of them and still maintain some level of quality standards.
I think the rule of thumb we've thrown around on this podcast in the past is, whether you are building it yourself in your spare time or you've hired someone to build it, you want to get to launch in 4 months, ideally 4 months or less, and no more than 6 months. That's when people really start losing motivation. That's where we see people drifting off, not finishing their app. And I've noticed, you know, working on Drip now since late November, early December, you know, one of the big things that has kept us going is knowing that our version 1.0 is just around the corner. Like, it always feels a few weeks away. And that's a good thing. Like, we know we have a short development time frame. We know that we kept V1.0 to a minimum feature set. And it does, it's not like we designed the schedule where it's like, all right, at the end of 2013, we're going to be done. Cause that's demotivational. It's just too far out. You're putting too many eggs in one basket, and you're adding a lot of risk to the project. Risk that you're never going to finish it, and risk that once you get there, that you've wasted a year of your spare time. So I actually have a question for you. When you first started AudiTrack, you've worked on it for several years now. Did you have a time frame in mind? Like, did you think that you were going to finish it in 6 months, or did you even think about a time frame? Or did you know, were you like, this is probably a 2-year development project since I'm doing it on the side?
I intentionally avoided putting together a timeline because I knew that it was such a large undertaking. If you look at my project file for it, it's not called Audit Shark, it's called Redwood. And part of the reason it was called Redwood was because I knew that it was just a massive, massive project. And the idea is, obviously, a redwood is a giant tree. Putting that in there as the project, it made me think about that on occasion, that this is a long-term goal, this is a massive project that is not going to be finished overnight.
So in a way, you've kind of broken this rule, right? You didn't necessarily budget time, but you didn't look at a schedule, right? You didn't really have a horizon in mind. How do you think you've overcome that? Because it seems like that would be demotivating for me to be, continue seeing like, all right, you know, it's another few months, and to see that for a year or two.
But the thing is, it's a different, because I would say that what I, in a way, I did budget my energy, because if I put together this schedule that was 2 or 3 years long, it would have been demotivational. And by intentionally avoiding it, basically doing the opposite, by not putting together that schedule, I did budget my energy, because I can break off little bits and pieces of it and implement those things, and it doesn't impact my morale. It doesn't impact my ability to get some of those things done.
Got it. And knowing what you know now, do you think that if you started it over again from scratch, that you could get it done in 6 months? That you could get something launched that people could use in this time frame that we talk about, the 4 to 6 month time frame?
It's hard to say, because there's a lot of the code that for certain components that I didn't build, and I spent a lot of time managing building of those. And while I was managing it, I wasn't necessarily working on it myself. So if I were to do everything, all of those things in parallel, I probably could have. But at the same time, I would have spent a huge amount of time upfront doing probably a pretty massive spec for it that I would have had to hand off to somebody or hand off to multiple people. I think that it could have been done, but I really would have had to have that spec up front, because there are certain things that I did where they ended up being more like prototypes in the way that they were put together. And some things became production code. Some things I ended up having to go back to the drawing board because they just didn't work out.
Right. And early on, your expectation of the market or the market that AutoChark would serve turned out to be different than you expected. So I'm sure that added months to it as well.
Right. So let's move on to number three. The third one is, if it works, ship it. It doesn't need to be perfect. And in fact, it will take years for the product to be perfect. But with each iteration, it's going to be better than the last iteration. What you need to do is you need to iterate more, and don't waste time on one massive first pass in order to get everything right. Because perfection is not the goal. You want to get the product out there so that people are using it and paying you for it. That's really what your goal is. Your goal is to get people who are going to give you money for it. If you wait until it's perfect, it's never going to be finished. You need to be able to overlook a lot of the small things, because there's things that you're going to do or have in the interface that like, oh, I don't know if that's worded quite right. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter when you're first launching. And it may 2, 3, 5 years down the road, but your goal is to get that first piece out there and then iterate over time to make it better, because it's a lot easier to iterate on something that already exists versus building something massive from scratch.
If you are personally relatively unknown and you don't have a massive launch list and you are really building something up from scratch where you don't have a lot of traffic up front, then I absolutely think that you should get something out there as quickly as possible. Just like Mike said, get a couple of people using it. Don't launch to everybody on day one. You know, as soon as you have something working, launch to everybody. That's a terrible way to do it. You do this small limited beta, maybe with one user, maybe with three. You get some feedback, then you get the next few in, the next few, then you slowly open it wider as you gain more confidence in your ability of the app to provide what it needs, you know, to your customers, as you add features, as you fix bugs, as you're able to support it, all these things. On the other side, if you already have, let's say, an audience, or you already have a large mailing list, or you already have a large personal brand, or you just already have a lot of people watching what you're doing, I think you need to be a little more careful with this, because obviously if you put something out that is very V.1, people are going to be more looking to rag on it, right? And to rag on you and to say, oh, look at so-and-so put out this app that sucks. So you have to be, I mean, I'm saying this obviously being aware that I'm launching Drip in 6 or 8 weeks, and we are putting polish on it that I wouldn't have put on an app that I launched 6 or 7 years ago. But I have this list of 13, they're the early access list. And then I have a mailing list of, you know, over 1,000 at this point. I'm not just going to email all those people and say, all right, come in and use the app. First, we're going to be customer number zero. I'm going to install it on Hittail, and we're going to iterate for about a week, maybe two, with the onboarding, with, you know, tweaking things. And to me, that's, we haven't shipped yet, technically, but we are iterating on it. We're not going to be adding new features at that point, right? Assuming it can do everything we need. Then we're going to get customer number one from that early access list. And we're going to go through the same cycle and probably spend a week, maybe two. And then we'll probably get two or three more. So I see it as like taking it in phases. And whether you do have a large launch list or not, taking it in steps is the way to go. And in my opinion, as soon as one customer is using it and paying you for it, you have, quote unquote, shipped it. If you are making progress a little bit at a time and you're iterating and people are getting value out of it and paying you for it, even if you haven't launched to the world, I still think I would say that that counts. And that is a better way to go, a gradual approach, rather than, you know, unleashing it to thousands on day one.
Tip number four is to do what you enjoy and outsource the rest. For the core tasks that you need to accomplish with launching a product, you need to understand why it is that you don't enjoy those things. Is it because you are just not interested in them? Is it because you're not familiar with them? Is it because you feel like you're not any good at them? And understanding that is kind of key to getting your product out the door.
Let's talk about a few tasks that people might enjoy or not enjoy. Email support. I don't know many people who enjoy that ongoing. I think early on, as the founder, you do want to do some email support, especially as a bootstrap founder where you don't have a team. It gives you a lot of insight into what your customers are doing, thinking, saying, the problems they're having and all that. But as the months tick on, as you get more customers, you get more support and you start seeing the same things over and over, that's where you're going to stop enjoying it. And most founders I see who continue to do it after that point start to get a little burned out. And so that was obviously, since it is a recurring task and it can be fairly systematized pretty easily, I would say that that's when you should outsource early.
All that information is great for after you have launched your product, but let's back up a little bit. What about before you've launched the product? What sorts of things can you outsource, or what sorts of things do people not like about launching products or not good at them?
Yeah, boy, that's a long list. I mean, I know some folks like myself, I don't enjoy design at all, right? Because I'm not good at it. And so that's something that I've outsourced heavily since day one. And if you are not good at it or you don't enjoy design, I think that is a no-brainer to outsource because there are a lot of good designers out there. Some folks I know don't know how or don't enjoy the coding side of it. For sure, that's something we've espoused on the podcast. I think there's also research tasks online. Research either of competition or of potential customers, potential beta testers, all that stuff. Hitting up Google is not a hard task to do. And if you outline some good criteria, it's pretty easy to find someone who can do research for you. I also think, you know, even stuff like once you get a design back from a designer, you need to slice it into HTML, CSS. You need to then turn it into dynamic files, either Ruby, PHP, .NET, whatever your poison is. All of that is quite easily outsourced to folks. It's whether you have the time or the money and whether you want to do it or not. But I definitely think that constructing the website is certainly something, if you're a developer, that you can do. But I would actually encourage you to spend more time on this other stuff, like getting your marketing message down, getting your value proposition, your positioning, figuring out which of those are key elements. And, you know, really doubling down on those. And that allows you to then write your website content. It allows you to put together a marketing plan. I haven't heard of anyone outsourcing a marketing plan unless they have a lot of money. Like, that you need to hire an agency if you want someone to really head that up. The small bootstrap founders I know, that's the one thing you don't outsource. You can outsource pieces of your marketing, but you don't outsource the vision of it and the deep, deep level understanding. That's where entrepreneurs who are bootstrapping, who are successful, tend to excel. And then, you know, I think the other thing you mentioned was customer development, talking to customers, realizing, yeah, most people aren't going to enjoy that. I mean, I don't think anyone I know actually enjoys going out without a product and trying to get people's pain points and talking to someone, cold calling them, cold emailing them. Once you talk to them, it's a lot of fun because you realize that they aren't actually mad at you, right? The people are wanting to talk to you because you could potentially help them down the line, especially if you're not selling to them right now. They're really open to talking to you about your ideas and about giving you feedback. But I think there is this kind of this fear or this myth that the customer development is really hard. And I think each of us feel that fear when we do go to cold call or cold meet up with a potential customer. Now, I haven't heard of anyone outsourcing it. I know you mentioned outsourcing some things, but certainly customer development, I think, is something that the founders have to do themselves.
Part of my point was to make sure that if there are core tasks that have to be accomplished, like customer development, that you understand why it is that you don't enjoy them. Is it because you're afraid of doing them? Is it because you don't think you're very good at them? And, you know, customer development, especially when you don't have a product, as you said, it's very difficult for somebody to start reaching out to people and saying, hey, would you be interested in this? Or is something like this going to solve problems that you're encountering? Because you don't actually have anything that you can show them. All you can do is talk to them about it. And that can be a little scary, a little disconcerting. But at the same time, I mean, I've had some really good conversations over the past couple of weeks with some extremely large companies who have a particular problem that Audit Shark does not currently solve, but it could down the road, and it fits very, very well into kind of a more enterprise-y offering for them. So those kind of conversations, for me at least, have kind of driven, I'll say, the future of the product. And it's not that I'm going to go implementing them today. I don't think it's going to be for probably 6 or 8 months before I start getting there. But it starts to help shape your vision of what the product is going to become down the road.
Why do you think it's so important that the founder needs to learn why they don't like the core tasks?
I think if you don't understand why you don't like it, then you simply avoid doing it. And if you are avoiding doing it, then obviously you're not going to get any value out of it. But at the same time, like, for example, customer development, if you just don't do customer development, then you get into a situation where you're probably 12 or 18 months into the process because you haven't talked to anybody and you've tried to launch it 2 or 3 times and it just hasn't gone anywhere because you didn't talk to anybody about it and nobody wants it. Nobody cares because you're not actually solving someone's problem. And it all comes back to the reason being that you did not talk to people. So if you understand that you don't like doing that, then it's something that you can consciously make decisions about and consciously address. Whereas if you're not acknowledging it, then you're probably just going to avoid it. So tip number 5 is to track your progress. And there are a lot of different ways that you can track progress. You know, maybe it's based on your features or different customer development tasks or marketing tasks. You can use all kinds of different things. You can use spreadsheets, you can use bug tracking, you can use burn down charts. Pretty much anything goes at this point. I mean, you can even use Trello to basically line up all of your different to-do tasks and then move them around as needed. But the idea here is that you really want to understand where you are in the process and be able to track that stuff and figure out roughly when you're going to be done. And if you are able to zero in on a specific date or a deadline for completing all those tasks, that can help in your motivational factors.
I think most people avoid doing estimates at the beginning of a project because I think that they don't want to be wrong because that makes them feel bad. And I think perhaps they don't want to face the music of, wow, if I really build this like I think I'm going to, it is going to take 8 or 9 months since I can only work 15 hours a week. I can't underscore how critical being able to see your progress on an ongoing basis, how critical that is to your motivation, to seeing an estimated completion date either stand still as you work or move itself backwards if you get ahead and actually become an earlier date. And knowing that you are burning this stuff down. You know, I think over the years I've used Fogbugs for this. I've used Excel spreadsheets. Joel Spolsky had, what was it called? It was like a project estimate sheet. If you Google that, you'll find it. And I also have it in a Google Doc now, and that's what we're using for Drip. And there's this awesome function called Workday where you can just say, you give it a date, which is now, and then you add up all the remaining hours, and it knows holidays. It has default holidays. You can add in holidays, and it will give you a date that this project's going to be completed, and it excludes weekends. It excludes major holidays. It's pretty crazy how accurate this thing can be, and even it's like we talked about last episode, even if it's off by a few days or by a week, it is still so much more clear than if you have nothing and are just basically driving in the dark.
Yeah, the one thing about that I found is that in order for that to work, you really have to be diligent about going into every single line item and making sure that you assign a time estimate to it. Because if you don't, then you're just not going to get good results out of it. But I really like the way Fogbugs does it because they give you a probability that you're going to complete it on any given date. And then there's this range of probabilities across multiple dates that says, there's a 90% chance you'll be done with it by April 30th, but there's only a 50% chance you'll be done with it by April 15th.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to go. Those estimates, though, if you don't have any history in their system of estimating and then completing things, it has no idea how good of an estimator you are. And over time, as you build history, it will become more and more exact, in terms of the estimates, because it knows you're personally a better estimator. And then if someone else is a worse estimator, it'll take that into account. So when you first start out, it's actually not very accurate, but you have to follow this and track your time. And you do have to do line items, just like if it was an Excel spreadsheet. You do have to say, it took me this long, so that Fogbugs knows, knows how long it took you, knows how to adjust your estimates up and down. That's the thing. When I'm using an Excel spreadsheet, I mean, there's no better way that I've found, to be honest. You have to figure out for yourself what you're going to actually update. You can't have 1,000 line items. at half an hour each, right? That's not going to work. I mean, you have to narrow it down to 50 or 100 or some small enough number that when you're done working and you log out for the night, that you go in there and it should take 30 seconds to just scan through. Boom, I work 4 hours on this, and you're done, you know. And if there are overages, then you put them in there, and the spreadsheet will show, and it'll push the thing out. I mean, it's not 100% accurate, but even if it's only 90 or 95, it's just shocking how much this will do towards keeping you motivated to finishing the project.
And some of what you just said leads into tip number 6, which is to set goals and celebrate your milestones. One of the things that I've done with Audit Shark is that inside of Fogbugs, which is where I do the vast majority of the tracking for it, I've set up different milestones based on a specific date. So instead of looking at this giant list of 1,000 or 2,000 line items, what I'll do is I will assign them to individual dates. So I might have, I call them sprints inside of Fogbugs, but I'll basically set up all these different milestones, and I'll say sprint 17, 18, et cetera. And I'll just assign them to be completed on a specific date. And then I'll take a bunch of cases and assign them to a particular sprint. And I'll say, okay, well, I want these things to be done on this particular date, and they'll be part of this sprint. And if it starts to get too many things in there, I'll start looking through those and seeing what I can push out into the future. And that way, when I'm looking at these different milestones, it's easy for me to see whether or not I'm trying to squeeze too much work effort into a too short of a time period. It also allows me to see whether or not I'm essentially keeping up with all the tasks that I put on my plate, or the tasks that I put on other people's plates. So the last tip that we have is to know when to give up and move on. Don't be pigheaded and simply keep going on your product because you committed to the idea. If Google releases something that renders your product irrelevant, you need to move on. And you need to be able to recognize that there are certain factors that are just way beyond your control, that there's literally nothing you can do about them. And when those things come up, you need to just give up and go find something else.
Let's bat around a few factors that could be reasons to move on, and maybe some factors of things that you shouldn't move on, but may, you know, maybe you think you should, but you shouldn't actually do it.
So the first one that comes to mind for me is literally if Google or Microsoft or somebody like that comes out with an idea that is almost exactly what you're working on. Now, if you're doing something that is a very niche product and Microsoft has something that it does that in a general way, but you have something that's targeted for a particular niche that could use it, I think you're probably okay. However, what was it? Was it Kiko that had a calendar, a web-based calendar system? Yep. And then they ended up shutting it down after Google came out with the Google Calendar.
Right. And I wonder if, you know, could they have pivoted that into a niche? Or did they even want to? Or did they have too much money raised that going into a niche play would have just rendered the business model useless and made it a non-success? Because if you were a bootstrapper and you'd built Kiko, I actually think you could have still, even with free Google Calendar, you could have built a business out of it if you convinced people to in a niche that you could provide them more value. And of course, you did provide them more value and then charged money, because it's a differentiator. There's still calendars that people pay for out there.
Yeah, I think that the issue there was that because they were angel funded, you know, what sort of investment are you going to be able to get back? Who's going to end up buying that? And maybe they built it with the intention of possibly Google acquiring it down the road, or maybe that was kind of their initial thought when they were coming out with ideas of who would buy it. I think what you just said rings true, is where if it was a bootstrapper who did it, you could definitely pivot it. But when you're talking about that particular product with a angel or VC funded backing, I think that it becomes a lot more difficult to say, oh, well, we were going to go big with this, but we're going to go smaller now. I think those justifications become much more difficult, and those conversations are much more difficult. It's easier to just shut the thing down and say, look, Google's coming out with this. They're offering it for free. There's not very many places that this can go anymore.
I have a scenario. What if you're in the middle of building your app? You're maybe 3 months in, it's going to take 6 months, and there really isn't a major competitor in that space, and then suddenly two other startups launch in that space. Whether they're funded or not, they launch and they have decent products, and you can tell they know what they're doing. Do you think that's reason to shut it down?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not in that situation, but I think that I would probably keep an eye on them. But if you're 3 months in and your total development time was 6 months, it seems to me like having those two competitors, you know, if there were no competitors before, now there's two, in some ways that's a validation of the market, and it means that there is, you know, money there and people are willing to pay for it. So I don't know as I would back off at that point. If you were doing something, you know, say several years ago in like the mobile management space, and, you know, obviously nobody was there at the time, and then everybody started going there, or everyone started building all these mobile management applications, and now if you look at the landscape, there's like 50 or 60 different companies who are doing something in this area, and it's a little bit late to be jumping in. I think that's a completely different scenario, though, because, you know, obviously the time cycle is longer, and then you've also got the fact that if you're early in versus a latecomer, those are a lot of different factors that go into it.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with you on that. If you're in process and you're at least have the launch date in sight and new competitors crop up, that it wouldn't be a big deal. Now, if one of those new competitors was, as you said, Google or Microsoft, that would make me pause and reevaluate. And if it wasn't two competitors, but it was nine competitors by some bizarre coincidence, everyone moved into that space, that would also make me at least pause and reevaluate and consider shutting down the doors. It's obviously very case-by-case basis. I mean, it's very specific. There's a lot of factors that play into this. I think the thing is you want to try to keep a rational head as much as you can, because it's easy to get discouraged and to let emotion get into it, right? To let your emotion drive you down, to become kind of disillusioned with the idea. You get bored with it. Oh, you know, it's not going to be successful anyways because these two new competitors have crept in. That is really easy to do if you are a one-person team and not getting any positive feedback or not getting any of the goals and celebrations of your milestones.
Right. But there's always, for any given piece of software where there's a gorilla, I mean, there's always room for much smaller competitors. And it really depends a lot on the niche that you're going into. But as you said, I mean, if it's a difference between two people cropping up, two new competitors versus nine or 10 in the space of a couple of months, I would agree with you that if it were nine or 10 that popped up, I might just give up at that point and go find something else that is probably going to be less competitive. If it's only two, I don't know as I would worry about it as much, especially if one of those two was funded in any way, because you never know. You may get down the road and they may become the gorilla, but people are looking for an alternative to it.
So to recap our seven tips for finishing your product, number one is don't chase everything that moves. Number two is budget your time, energy, and other resources. Number three is if it works, ship it. Number four, do what you enjoy and outsource the rest. Number five, track your progress. Number six, set goals and celebrate your milestones. And number seven is know when to give up and move on. If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt for Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. See you next time.